the decisions to the non-tribal aspect of it? The answer, in my view, is yes. I know of no authority to the contrary. Not to my knowledge.
My point is I have an Indian reservation on my district.
As they should be.
Right. And my point is that I think legitimate. I just don't want to see us using the sledgehammer to crack an egg. Process. There, I can't see how, if the Indians wanted to stand in the way, they could pull out the bill from operating.
Again, I'm sensitive to that concern as well, and I don't see any reason why a bill cannot be drafted to ensure that we're not encroaching upon tribal sovereignty. Again, I want to make sure that my purpose, my intent was to limit this amendment to the opening up of the process establishing non-treaty fishing seasons, and in no way affecting the tribal decision-making process. In no way. I believe the settlement document that I entered into with the state, again, that was the subject of a lot of discussion back and forth, does that. It does not encroach upon the tribal sovereignty, and I believe a bill can be drafted to that effect as well here.
Question, Representative Baum.
One last question. Governing body, by making it a member or members, what's your intent as sponsor of the bill with that? It looks like it. Like I could be walking down the road and talk with anyone who might be impacted by the decision, and I'll be involved in an open meeting.
Well, I can appreciate that. Let me tell you why I made that amendment or suggested that amendment. The reason is this, that typically the meetings, these private meetings at which the seasons are negotiated, involve representatives from the various government agencies. In Oregon's case, it has been one individual member who essentially negotiates on behalf of the state of Oregon and says, okay, Oregon can live with this, and then comes back to the department and says, this is what I negotiated, then goes to the commission. The commission, historically, privately, in executive session, would affirm that, and then at the compact, we have this sham ceremonial hearing to approve a decision that's been negotiated by one single member. In my lawsuit that I filed, the state said, aha, the reason that your lawsuit is flawed is because we only had one member at these private meetings negotiating, and it says members, plural. Clearly, this is not a governing body. My point in obviously in drafting this bill, an amendment, was to prevent that out from being present. What I think it legitimately can be, because if you look at the law, it provides only that it applies to governing bodies meeting to decide or deliberate toward a decision on any matter, et cetera. It doesn't apply to any members meeting for any reason. It's only when you're deliberating toward a decision or deciding toward. Moreover, because I'm really only intending to broaden the definition to include these meetings where we've got a single member of an Oregon government but other members, perhaps we can cure it with a drafting amendment, an appropriate amendment, and I would suggest that's the answer. Again, my intent is not to hamstring government throughout the state, and I want to be sensitive to those concerns because I think they are legitimate, and I would suggest that an appropriate amendment is what we need here in the drafting of the language.
Representative Edmondson.
Would it, is the situation where a single member is present, is that member designated by the public body to act in a particular way?
Absolutely.
So if we were to say governing body means a member designated by any public body to act.
A wonderful suggestion,
Representative Edmondson. That would take care of this problem without unwittingly subjecting individual members to an unworkable interpretation of the public meetings law.
Yes, I think so. And again, I want to express my willingness to help draft amendments and given the direction of this committee to work with you if I can to solve what I think is a legitimate problem and what I think is a good government bill.
I appreciate that, and I agree with that. My concern is that we started off being as generic, I think, as we could be, and I'm a little bit weak on the history of the public body open meeting law in Oregon. Maybe Representative Mason can help out here, but it seems to me that there was a reason why we used a laundry basket generic description of what bodies we're applying this law to, rather than starting to list them individually. And I'm a little bit concerned about the precedent that we create as a legislature when we start to carve out special groups of or special bodies to which this should specifically apply. Does that exclude any body that we do not specifically include? Does that mean that in the next session of the legislature we're going to have representatives from timber interest groups here to talk about what goes on and ask for a special listing of, you know, those bodies which determine timber harvest? I mean, I suppose there are other areas where resource allocation is a decision, and then we can launch off from the topic of resource allocation to any decision that's handled by any kind of public body, and pretty soon we're going to have to list them all in the statute. I'm just concerned that we somehow find a generic way of describing the need that's not being met here by the open meetings law, describe it generically so that we get some coverage and move on from there. So I'd appreciate some assistance with that.
That's a fair question, but I think the answer to that is that no, this would not set an unfortunate precedent which would result in multitudes of special interest groups converging upon the legislature next session to carve out some neat little exception for them. I really do believe that the decision-making process that involves the establishment of fishing seasons on the Columbia River is unique. It is unique primarily because of the tribal rights that inhere in the fishing resource. And it is unique because of the court-ordered decision that gives the tribes co-management authority. I know of no other public resource in which, in this state at least, the tribes are also involved or who have been in which the tribes have been invested with that same authority. So I don't believe there's any basis for other groups descending upon the legislature to carve out yet another exception. At least I'm not aware of any. So I really do believe that this is a unique situation which requires a unique exception, and I've tried to draft and craft the legislation to do just that.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Hanlon and Mr. Tenson.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who is here to testify on House Bill 2007? If not, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2007 and move on to public hearing on House Bill 3371. William Keyes. Judge Keyes just walked out.
Are you sure? I do want to think about this baby. Is there something?
Deja vu all over again.
Judge. Judge Keyes, good afternoon. We were just commenting here at the table that this seems like we've all been here before.
Yes.
I want to remind you that the committee, this committee is very bright. We remember everything that you told us last time you were here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Keyes. I'm a judge in Multnomah County, although I have to say that I'm probably appearing in my capacity as a citizen rather than as a member of the judiciary. I don't represent the judiciary in introducing this legislation. The last time we were here, I think we talked a lot about the details of this bill, and I didn't talk a whole lot about why I think it ought to be a law. I'll be happy to address questions, and I've got a couple of things that were raised in the last meeting that I want to address, but I want to spend some time talking about why I think forfeiture may be an answer to a number of problems that we have in our state. The first is that the present system simply doesn't work. I think there'll be a number of people here to testify to that, but the current criminal justice system is simply incapable of providing any meaningful sanctions to those who are guilty of driving while suspended as a result of drunk driving. And as a result, most defendants don't pay any attention to the law. I think by providing some kind of a meaningful sanction, but more important, by removing the instrumentality of the crime, namely the automobile, it's my hope that we can actually get a decrease in the amount of cases that result and the amount of people who are actually violating this law. I think we do know that because of an overcrowded criminal justice system, there are no meaningful sanctions. A number of counties simply don't prosecute these offenses. I'm further informed that you just about can't go to jail in Lincoln County, for instance, for any misdemeanor, including a driving while suspended case. In Multnomah County, people are consistently released from custody no matter how many times they fail to appear on these charges because the jail's too full. Because of overcrowding in my county, you can see that in a one-week period in Multnomah County, about 90 people were released pretrial, substantially before the conclusion of their case, who were charged with driving while suspended. 50 were released substantially before their sentence was concluded on drunk driving, again, because of crowded conditions. When you finally send somebody to the penitentiary, the corrections division makes no bones about the fact they're going to get rid of those people out of the system as quickly as possible, somewhere between 30 and 40 days. But even with that quick turnaround time, we consistently have, at least the last time I talked to Michael Franke about this some months ago, about 120 people in the penitentiary consistently on this charge, and that's taking up bed space that we hopefully can use more effectively for people charged with manslaughter and murder and robbery. I think there's also, we're clearly in a situation in our court system where court-appointed attorney's costs, I can see I'm dazzling the committee.
Do this to everyone that's not selective, Judge.
Court-appointed attorney's fees are rapidly growing out of control. We've had a number of problems over the years where they've exceeded the budget. I don't see a whole lot of court-appointed attorneys getting rich handling court-appointed attorney work. So I don't see much of an answer in further chopping their rates. It's just not a realistic answer. No. The only choices then left are try to get people to commit less crimes, to try to be a little more efficient, although I think there are some limits in that, and to charge less people with crimes. This bill is truly one way to begin to try to find some solutions and some answers other than just charging people with crimes. And I honestly think the thing might work. I don't mean that it might work and that it might be efficient or save money. I honestly think that this might be like Senate Bill 710 a few years ago that actually changed behavior. I know that 710 was a bill that changed how my friends drank and drove. There are more designated drivers now, and I'm sure that's true for you too, than there used to be. We actually changed behavior. I think this bill is capable of doing that as long as we get the bill plus enough publicity about it. People are going to quit loaning their car to people who they think may be drunk drivers. People are going to quit driving cars who are drunk drivers because they know they're going to have their friends awfully mad at them if they get their cars picked up, or they're going to get their own car seized. So I think this is a bill that may actually change behavior, and we don't have that happening very often in the criminal justice system. Now, I'd like to answer very, very briefly some of the concerns that I heard raised at our last session. First, on Article 1, Section 25. Both Mark McDonald and I, Mark McDonald, who's going to testify from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and myself, looked up all the cases in the state of Oregon we could find on this. He did most of the work, by the way. I have two major approaches to this. Number one, in this case, there isn't a conviction, and I think that is one exception to that constitutional provision. But more important, what that constitutional provision historically covered is nothing to do with this situation. And the two words as used in the Constitution, corruption of blood and forfeiture, in my analysis, are terms of art, are legal terms that had a specific meaning at that time. And basically what they, under the feudal system, those people convicted of a felony not only stood to lose their lands and their rights to property, but their children stood to lose it. And that was the corruption of blood part of it. We looked at the two cases. It was, Mr. McDonald can address it in more detail, but it was clear to me that this language is a term of art. It was a term that had clear meaning at the time the Constitution was adopted. It did not address this problem, and so I don't think it's a problem. The second problem that was raised by Chair Bauman was the whole question of Brown versus Multnomah County. And that's, can decriminalizing a charge result in a problem in terms of denying people constitutional rights? In other words, when is something which is declared not to be a crime still a crime in terms of being required to provide constitutional rights? On the basis of that, I went back and read Brown versus Multnomah County about three more times. And I came to the following conclusions. First, Justice Lindy said that was a very close case. If that was a very close case, this is not a close case for the following reasons. Two of the most important things that Brown talked about were collateral consequences, loss of license and that sort of thing. And by the way, Mr. Silver is going to raise an issue about whether or not conviction, if we adopt this bill, whether driving under these circumstances, which is not a crime, should constitute an offense which makes one a habitual offender. Quite honestly, it was an oversight on my part. I did not address the issue. I agree with Mr. Silver. I think it would create problems under Brown versus Multnomah County, and I agree that when he makes, at least from my standpoint, that we ought not to make this event, if you will, this infraction, be an event which triggers the habitual offender consequences.
Chair, can I ask you?
Representative Baum.
Tell me, in Northeast Oregon, when you get somebody for driving while suspended, they get jail time, 10 to 30, 60 days, depending on how many times they're caught. Usually, you really reduce the put them in jail for 10 days the first time. But I know you don't have that option in some counties because there's other priority crimes that seem to be filling up the place. By the amendments.
Maybe we can rent some of your jail space.
We do that. We rent 25 spaces to the state of Oregon. Anything to help property tax holders out. Point being, is this mandatory with the judge? They have to
not prosecute criminals. Is that what you're saying?
Bar.
Yes.
They have to. The judge has to. The
judge doesn't have to. The officer sees the car.
The officer sees the car.
Yes.
Okay, but some judge down the road has to make it permanent, doesn't he?
DMV can make it permanent, or the person, if it's going to be a forfeiture, has the option of asking for a jury trial. Yes.
Now, what happens if we made it a may option instead of a shall? Counties that have the real problem and can't put them in jail can do this other thing, have the discretion to do it.
I suggested in a meeting with the representative of the governor's office and a representative of the attorney general's office that was something that I suggested we look at. The attorney general's office had some concerns about that. They felt that selective enforcement on a county option basis might create some problems. Let me just say this. I think our problem statewide is a serious one. I'm suggesting that this is a two-year experiment, if you will, to see if we can change people's behavior because of this. I'm suggesting that a statewide approach is worth the risk to a Northwest Oregon county, and that there'd be less effect if we get a much better effect in the various other counties in the state. We can then, in 2 years, look at this, because this has clearly got a sunset provision on it, and there's supposed to be a study of this by DMV and the governor's office 2 years from now and analyze it. Did it work in smaller counties? Did it work in larger counties? What worked? What didn't? How can we fix it? What can we do to correct it? But I think a statewide approach, based on what I've been told by a number of people, is probably the only course we can take, despite the fact it has differing consequences to various counties. Does that?
I just wanted to make sure that we don't have any alternate means of transportation.
Now, there that is a problem, and that's the major reason why I made the first offense under this is a situation where somebody can pay a $500 civil penalty and pay the storage and the towing and get the car back. Even though you're convicted of driving under the influence, and even though you drove the car, the first time you can get the car back by paying $500. And the major reason I did that is to provide for this problem of a family with no alternative means of transportation. The second thing I want to address about that is after the first time, I think we have to make, as a society, make some choices about which family is going to suffer, the family of the driver or the family of the victims. I gave them the first time that they can get the car back, but after that, we've got to make some societal choices.
Representative Minnis, while we're interrupting you, Representative Minnis has a question.
Judge Keyes, you remember the last time you testified on this bill, I asked you a question about the admissibility of evidence, the body in the trunk example that I used, and that time you were unaware as to whether or not that evidence could be used in a subsequent criminal prosecution for a crime related to that evidence, marijuana, dead bodies, those kind of things. Have you come to any conclusions as to whether or not in this civil process that evidence could be used?
First of all, first let me say that my understanding is that in about a third of these cases, and I'm approximating here, there are other crimes associated with this charge. 30 to 40% of the time, when you're picked up for felony driving while suspended because of drunk driving, you're picked up for an additional drunk driving, a theft, another traffic offense, which is a crime. That then would not be a problem in those cases. So we're talking about those that remain. One of the things that often occurs is that people are picked up, in addition to that, for failure to present or display a license, which remains a crime, and is subject to arrest until the officer determines that they have actually determined the identity of the person involved. That takes care of another bulk of these cases. For the remaining cases, I don't think you can use the body in the trunk. Maybe somebody from the DA's office can give you something else, but I just think that's part of the price we pay for decriminalization of anything. And I recognize there are a lot of things in our pressures on people in the legislature not to decriminalize for some of these reasons, but I also see enough potential advantages that I honestly believe the risk is worth it, and so do a number of other people here from the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay. The costs of the bill are something that I think some information has been provided to you. Mr. Linden from the Justice Department has indicated that we should save somewhere between $300,000 and $600,000 by getting these cases out of the criminal justice system. DMV tells me that they think that this should cost, I'm surprised at the number, and I'm going to spend some more time because we haven't had a chance to go through it with DMV's assumptions here, but they think it's going to cost $1.6 million. According to DMV, then, we'd have it would cost $1 million.
Representative Edmondson.
Yes.
We've just received a fiscal analysis of this legislation that says it will cost DMV about $10 million.
I think that's a very old fiscal analysis, and they're going to provide you with some.
It says date prepared May 1.
You may want to look at that.
Well, somebody's here from DMV, and am I correct that you said $1.6 million? You mind?
Go ahead. No, come on up.
That's why I asked.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Edmondson, Jim Hunter, Motor Vehicles Division Deputy Administrator. The original fiscal impact statement that I believe that was distributed to the committee by Legislative Fiscal was based on the original bill draft and concepts that we had at that time. Obviously, there have been several amendments since then. We have -4 amendments now. We have, based on those amendments, revised our fiscal impact, provided that to the Legislative Fiscal Office, and it is substantially revised because of those amendments. It's still estimates, as Judge Keyes indicates. We need further discussion to look at some of the assumptions that we made in there. I will cover that in some subsequent testimony, but on a biennial basis, it looks like difference between revenue and costs is working out somewhere around $1.6, $1.7 million, somewhere in that.
That's for 2 years.
For 2 years, biennial cost.
Yeah, Mr. Hunter, when did you provide our fiscal analyst with your best information so that we can get this straight? Because we do have a fiscal analysis dated May 1 that's pretty far apart from your figures.
Madam Chair, this was provided, I believe, to you by Legislative Fiscal Office.
No, I'm asking, when did you give Legislative Fiscal your most recent run?
Madam Chair, I believe that was given to Legislative Fiscal last Friday or Monday or this morning. We did not receive the most recent amendments until then.
Thank you.
What that means is that we're somewhere between, based on Mr. Linden's per year savings of between 3 and 6, somewhere between close to breaking even and costing $600,000.
That's better than $10 million.
A lot better than $10 million. I would imagine that this bill would receive short shrift at $10 million impact.
Especially on this committee.
We still have some serious problems on this bill, and the biggest problem in my mind is still the problem of the security interest holders. I have started meeting with representatives of the financial industry in October and November. We've made any number of changes in the bill, both as a result of their prior comments and as a result of Mr. Sherman's recent letter. Quickly, the green is the changes we've made based on Mr. Sherman's letter of about 10 days ago, and the yellow is changes we've made previously. I can say in general, and I'm sure Mr. Sherman will address it in detail, that we have cleaned up the majority of the procedural questions that they were concerned about. Not all, but the majority of them. And as you can see, they were substantial.
I think it might be useful to walk with you through those changes right now, because we've got a 56-page -4 amendment in front of us. And can you just walk us through the changes? Let us know.
Sure.
So that we can mark those. And if you can also summarize what the change addresses for us, that'll be helpful.
Section 3, lines 21 and 22, from the word unless until the word 811-180. Addresses, do you have a copy of Mr. Sherman's letter?
No.
Okay. Okay, let me take a moment then to go through. I know what I changed. I don't know in short form what the problem was that he raised. But basically,
would it help if Mr. Sherman were to come up and sit with you while you go through the bill for us?
Madam Chairman, I have substantive testimony that I'll be giving.
Okay. Well, we'll wait for you. Why don't you, Judge, why don't you go through as well as you can, and Ken will take us through.
All right. Mr. Sherman raised the question of those people where it's clear to the officer, this is on Section 3, lines 21 and 22, where it's clear to the officer that the person has an affirmative defense, for instance, a medical emergency, that the officer, the police officer ought not to seize the car. Made sense to me. We changed it. On page 3, lines 11, 12, and 13, Sherman had a concern about that this legislation might prevent someone filing an independent lawsuit to determine the ownership of property. I didn't want it to. It didn't make any sense to do it, so we changed it. And that's lines 11, starting with the word nothing, through line 13. Am I going too fast?
Well, it's been great.
I have a question. Okay.
Representative Minnis.
Question. I'm a little confused. The language in the dash 4 amendments we're looking at, is that your new language, or are you proposing new language that's been changed?
No, this is all changes in the Dash 4 amendments.
The Dash 4 amendment are as the, you want them to be.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes. And what the Dash, in large part, the changes that constitute Dash in from slash 10 to 2282.
Right. Well, I just want to make sure it wasn't, there were not new concerns that we were trying to deal with.
There are three, right, which I'm going to address.